Santon was unusually quiet during the meal. Tara had placed her beside Manfred, but she listened attentively to everything that he said, and when they went through to the blue drawing-room at the end of the meal, she stayed close to Manfred, and the two of them were soon oblivious of everyone else, lost in rapt but low-voiced discussion. Manfred's statuesque blonde German wife, Heidi, had failed to enthrall Tara with a long-winded complaint about the laziness and dishonesty of her coloured servants, and Tara escaped as soon as she could and took another cognac to her father on the long blue velvet sofa, and then settled beside him. "Santon says that you admire de Larrey," she said quietly, and they both looked across at the other couple on the far side of the room. "He's a formidable piece of work," Blaine grunted. "Hard as iron and sharp as an axe. Do you know even his own colleagues call him Pangaman? Why does he fascinate Santin so much? She rang me and demanded an invitation when she knew he'd be here. She seems to have some sort of obsession with him. Why is that, Daddy, do you know?" Blaine dropped his eyes and considered the firm grey ash on his cigar. What could he tell her, he wondered. He was one of probably only four people in the world who knew Manfred de Larrey was Santon's bastard son. He remembered his own shock and horror when she had told him. Not even Shaza knew that he and Manfred were half-brothers, though Manfred knew, of course. Santon had told him. When she used it as blackmail to prevent Manfred destroying Shaza's political career back in 1948. It was all so complicated, and Blaine found himself disturbed, as he had been so often over the years, by the echoes of Santon's follies and indiscretions before he had met her. Then he smiled ruefully. She was still a fiery and impetuous woman, and he wouldn't have had it any other way. "I think she's interested in anything that affects Shaza's career. It's only natural she should be. De Larrey is Shaza's sponsor. It's as simple as that, my dear." "Yes, De Larrey is his sponsor," Tara agreed. "But what do you think, Daddy, about Shaza's turn of political coats?" Despite her resolution to remain calm, she had raised her voice in agitation, and Shaza, who was in intimate conversation with the French ambassador's chic and bold-eyed young second wife, heard his name across the room and glanced up in her direction. Tara dropped her voice quickly. "What do you think of it, Daddy? Weren't you simply appalled?" "I was at first," Blaine admitted, "but then I discussed it with Santon, and Shaza came to see me. We thrashed it out between us, and I had my say, but in the end I came to see his point of view. I don't agree with it, but I respect it. He believes that he can do the greatest good," Tara heard her own father repeating all Shaza's trite and glib justifications, and the sense of outrage overwhelmed her all over again. She found herself trembling with suppressed passion, and she wanted to scream out at them, Shaza and Santin, and her own father. But then she thought of Moses and the struggle, and with an effort she was able to retain her self-control. "I must remember everything," she told herself. "Everything that they say or do, even the smallest detail, might be of inestimable value to the struggle." So faithfully she reported it all to Molly Broadhurst. She slipped away from Weltefrieden at least once a week on the pretense of visiting her dressmaker or her hairdresser. She and Molly met only after Tara had taken elaborate precautions to make sure she was not followed. Her instructions were to cut all her left-wing connections and to refrain at all times from political or socialistic comments in the presence of others. Molly was her only contact with the real world of the struggle, and she treasured every minute of their time together. Miriam Africa was always able to bring the baby to be with her during these interludes, and Tara held him in her arms and fed him his bottle as she made her report to Molly. Everything about little Benjamin fascinated her, from the tight curls of crisp black hair that covered his scalp, through the exquisite softness and colour shading of his skin, honey and old ivory, down to the soles of his tiny feet, which were the palest, clearest coral pink. Then on one of her visits, Molly had another letter for her from Moses, and even the joy of holding baby Benjamin paled beside that of these written words. The letter had been written in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. Moses was there to address a meeting of the heads of the black African states at the express invitation of the Emperor Haile Selassie, and he described to her the warm welcome that he had been given and the offers of support, moral, financial and military, that had been pledged to the struggle in Azania. That was the new name for South Africa. It was the first time she had heard it, and when she repeated it aloud, the sound of it stirred a deep patriotic response in her that she had never felt before. She read the rest of Moses' letter. From here I'll travel to Algeria, where I will meet with Colonel Bamoudien, who is at this moment struggling against French imperialism, and whose great valour will surely bring freedom and happiness to his tragically oppressed land. After that I will fly to New York, and it seems certain that I will be allowed to put our case to the General Assembly of the United Nations. All this is exciting, but I have even better news that affects you and our baby, Benjamin. If you continue the important work you are doing for the cause, our powerful friends are determined to give you a special reward. Some day the three of us, you and me and Benjamin, will be together in London. I cannot tell you how greatly I look forward to holding my son and to greeting you again. I will write to you as soon as I have more definite news. In the meantime, I entreat you to continue your valuable work for the cause. In particular, you should make every effort to see that your husband is elected to the government front benches at the elections next month. This will make your position and value to the struggle unique. For days after receiving this letter, Tara's mood was so light and gay that both Shaza and Santan remarked on it, and took it as a sign that she had finally accepted her responsibilities as the mistress of Velter Frieden, and was prepared to honour the agreement that she had made with Shaza. When the Prime Minister announced the date of the general election, the country was immediately seized by the peculiar frenzy of excitement and intrigue which accompanies all major political activity in South Africa, and the newspapers began their strident and partisan pronouncements. Shaza's resignation from the United Party and his nomination as the nationalist candidate for the constituency of South Boerland was one of the highlights of the campaign. The English press castigated him, branding him as a coward and a traitor, while the Burger and the Transvaaler, those stalwarts of the nationalist cause, hailed him as a far-seeing man of the future and looked forward to the day when all white South Africans, albeit under the firm hand of the National Party, marched shoulder to shoulder towards the Golden Republic, which was the dream of all true South African patriots. Kitty Godolphin had flown back from New York to cover the elections and to update her famous Focus on Africa series that had won her another Emmy and had made her one of the highest paid of the new generation of young, pretty and waspish television commentators. Shaza's political defection was the headline story when she landed at Jan Smuts Airport, and she telephoned him from the airport on his private line and got him in his office just as the board meeting he had been chairing broke up, and he was about to leave Santon House to fly up to the honey mine for his monthly inspection. "Hi," she said gaily, "it's me." "You bitch," he recognised her voice instantly. "After what you did to me, I should kick your bottom, wearing hobnail boots and taking a full swing at that." "Oh, did you see it? Wasn't it good? I thought I captured you perfectly." "Yes, I saw it last month on BBC while I was in London. You made me look like a cross between Captain Bligh and Simon Legree, although more pompous than either and a lot less lovable." "That's what I said. I got you perfectly." "I don't know why I'm talking to you," he chuckled despite himself. "Because you are lusting after my miraculously beautiful body," she suggested. "I'd be wiser to make advances to a nest of hornets." "We aren't talking wisdom here, buddy boy. We're talking lust. The two are not compatible." And Shaza had a poignant vision of her slim body and her perfect little breasts, and he felt slightly breathless. "Where are you?" he asked. "Johannesburg Airport." "What are you doing this evening?" He made a quick calculation. He could postpone the Harney Mine inspection, and it was 4 hours flying time to Johannesburg in the Mosquito. "I'm open to suggestions," she told him, "as long as the suggestions include an exclusive interview for NABS on your change of political status and your view of the upcoming elections and what they mean to the ordinary people of this country." "I should know better," he said. "But I'll be there in 5 hours. Don't go away." Shaza placed the receiver back on its cradle and stood for a moment wondering at himself. His change of plans would throw the entire company into consternation, for he had a tight schedule laid out for the weeks ahead, including the opening of his election campaign. But the woman had woven some sort of spell around him. Like a malignant sprite, her memory had danced at the edge of his mind all these months. And now the thought of being with her filled him with that quivering expectation he had not known since he was a lad embarking on his very first sexual explorations. The Mosquito was fueled and parked on the hard stand, ready for the flight to Harney Mine. It took him 10 minutes to calculate his new flight plan and file it with air traffic control. And then he climbed up into the cockpit, and grinning like a schoolboy playing hooky, he cranked the Rolls-Royce Merlin engines. It was dusk when he landed, but a company car was waiting for him, and he drove directly to the Carlton Hotel in the centre of Johannesburg. Kitty was in the lobby as he came in through the revolving doors. She was fresh-faced as a teenager, long-legged and narrow-hipped in blue jeans, and she came to him with childlike enthusiasm and wrapped both arms around his neck to kiss him. Strangers in the lobby must have imagined Shaza was a father greeting his schoolgirl daughter, and they smiled indulgently. "They let us into your suite," she told him, as she led him towards the elevator, skipping beside him to keep pace and hugging his arm in a pantomime of adoration. Hank had got his camera and lights set up already. "You aren't even giving me time to visit the heads," Shaza protested, and she pulled a wry face. "Oh, let's get it over and done. Then we'll have more time for whatever you want to do afterwards." She gave him a devilish grin, and he wagged his head in reluctant acquiescence. It was deliberate, of course. Kitty was too professional to give him time to pull himself together and concentrate his mind. It was part of her technique to get her subject off balance, while on the other hand, she had been carefully preparing her own notes and questions during the 5 hours since they had spoken on the telephone. She had rearranged the furniture in his suite, making one corner into an intimate nook, and Hank had lit it and was standing by with his Arriflex. Shaza shook hands with him and exchanged a friendly greeting, while Kitty poured him a massive whiskey from the liquor cabinet. "Take your jacket off," she instructed as she handed it to him. "I want you relaxed and casual." She led him to the two facing chairs, and while he sipped his whiskey, she lulled him with an amusing account of the flight out, which had been delayed by bad weather in London for 8 hours. Then Hank gave her the signal, and she said sweetly, "Shaza Courtney, since the turn of the century, your family has been a traditional ally of General Smuts. He was a personal friend of your grandfather and your mother. He was a frequent guest in your house and sponsored your own entry into the political arena. Now you have turned your back on the United Party, which he led, and have deserted the fundamental principles of decency and fair play towards the coloured citizens of this country, which was so much a part of General Smut's philosophy. You have been called a deserter and a turncoat, and worse. Do you think that that is a fair description? And if not, why not?" The attack was so swift and savage that for a moment it checked him. But he had known what to expect, and he grinned. He knew he was going to enjoy this. General Smuts was a great man, but not quite as saintly towards the natives as you suppose. In all the time he was in power, their political status remained unchanged, and when they stepped out of line, he did not hesitate before sending in the troops and giving them a whiff of grape. Have you ever heard of the Bondelsvart Rebellion and the Bullhook Massacre? You are suggesting that Smuts also oppressed the native people of this country? No more than a strict headmaster oppresses his children. In the main, he never seriously addressed himself to the coloured question. He left that for a future generation to settle. We are that future generation. All right, so what are you going to do about the black people of this country, who outnumber you nearly 4-1, and have no political rights whatsoever in the land of their birth? Firstly, we will try to avoid the trap of simplistic thinking. Can you explain that? Kitty frowned. She didn't want him to wriggle out of her grip by using vague terminology. Give us a concrete example of simplistic thinking. He nodded. You glibly use the terms black people and white people, dividing this population into two separate, if unequal, portions. That is dangerous. It might work in America. If all the American blacks were given white faces, they would be simply Americans and think of themselves as that. You are suggesting that this is not the case in Africa? I am indeed, Shaza agreed. If all the blacks in this country were given white faces, they would still think of themselves as Zulus and Xhosas and Vendors. And we would still be English and Afrikaners. Very little would have altered. Kitty didn't like that. It was not what she wanted to tell her audiences. So, of course, you are ruling out the idea of a democracy in this country. You will never accept the policy of one man, one vote, but will always aspire to white domination. Shaza cut in on her quickly. One man, one vote would lead not to the black government you seem to foresee, but to a Zulu government. For the Zulus outnumber any other group. We would have a Zulu dictator, like good old King Shaka, and that would be a thrilling experience. So what is your solution? She demanded, hiding her irritation behind that little girl's smile. Is it white Baskup, white domination and savage oppression backed by an all-white army and police force? I don't know the solution, he cut her off. It's something we have to work towards. But I expect it will be a system in which every tribal group, whether it be black, brown or white, can maintain its identity and its territorial integrity. What a noble concept, she agreed. But tell me when, in the history of mankind, any group who enjoyed supreme political power over all others ever gave up that power without an armed struggle. Do you truly believe the white South Africans will be the first? We'll have to make our own history, Shaza matched her honeyed smile. But in the meantime, the material existence of the black people in this country is 5 or 6 times better than any other on the African continent. More is spent on black education, black hospitals, and black housing per capita than in any other African country. How does the expenditure per capita on black education compare with expenditure on white education? Kitty shot back at him. My information is that 5 times more is spent on the education of a white child than on a black. We will strive to correct that imbalance as we build up the wealth of our nation, as the black peasant becomes more productive and makes more of a contribution to the taxation that pays for that education. At the moment, the white section of the population pays 95% of the taxes. That wasn't the way the interview was meant to go, and Kitty headed him off smoothly. And just how and when will the black people be consulted in these changes? Is it fair to say that nearly all blacks, and certainly all the educated and skilled blacks, who are the natural leaders, totally reject the present political system which allows 1/6 of the population to decide the fate of the rest? They were still sparring when Hank lifted his head from the camera lens and rolled his eyes. Out of film, Kitty. You told me 20 minutes tops. We have 45 minutes in the can. Okay, Hank, my fault. I didn't realize we had such a garrulous bigot on the show. She smiled at Shaza acidly. You can wrap it up, Hank, and I'll see you in the morning. 9 o'clock at the studio. She turned back to Shaza, and they didn't even look up as Hank left the suite. So what did we decide? She asked Shaza. That the problem is more complex than anybody, perhaps even we in government, realize. Insoluble? Kitty asked. Certainly. Without delicacy and the utmost goodwill of everybody in the country and our friends abroad. Russia, she teased him, and he shuddered. Britain, he said. What about America? No, Britain understands. America is too wrapped up in her own racial problems. They aren't interested in the dissolution of the British Empire. However, we have always stood by Britain, and now Britain will stand by us. Your confidence in the gratitude of great nations is refreshing. However, I think you'll find that in the next decade there'll be an enormous riptide of concern over human rights emanating from the United States. At least I hope so. And North American broadcasting studios will be doing all in its power to build it up into a tidal wave. Your job is to report reality, not to attempt to restructure it, Shaza told her. You are a reporter, not the god of judgment. If you believe that, you're naive, she smiled. We make and destroy kings. Shaza stared at her as though he were seeing her for the first time. My God, you are in the power game, just like everybody else. It's the only game in town, buddy boy. You're amoral. No more than you are. Oh, yes, you are. We're prepared to make our decisions and live with the consequences. You wreck your destruction. Then, like a child with a broken toy, throw it aside and go on without a moment's remorse to some new cause that will sell more advertising time. He had made her angry. Her eyes slanted and narrowed into bright arrowheads, and the freckles on her nose and cheeks glowed like specks of gold leaf. It roused him to see her come out from behind the screen, as hard and formidable as any adversary he had ever faced. He wanted to goad her further, to make her give way completely. "You have made yourself the guru of Southern Africa on U.S. television for one reason only. Not for concern over the fate of the black masses, but quite simply because you smell blood and violence in the air. You have sensed that this is where the action will be next, and you want to be the one who captures it on film." "You bastard," she hissed at him. "I want peace and justice." "Peace and justice don't make good footage, Kitty, my love. You are here to record the killing and the screaming, and if it doesn't happen soon enough, well, that's easily fixed. You'll give it a little shove." She was out of her chair now, facing him, and her lips were frosty with rage. "For the last hour, you have been spouting the most vicious racial poison, and now you accuse me of injustice? You call me an agent provocateur for the violence that is coming?" He raised an eyebrow, giving her the taunting, supercilious smile which had enraged his opponents across the floor of the house, and it was too much for her to bear. She sprang at him, white-lipped and shaking with fury, and she clawed for his single mocking eye with both hands. Shaza caught her wrists and lifted her feet clear of the floor. She was shocked by his strength, but she lifted her knees sharply, driving for his groin. He turned slightly and caught the knee on the hard muscle of his thigh. "Where did a nice girl learn a trick like that?" he asked, and twisted her arms behind her, took both her wrists in his left hand, and then bowed over her. She pressed her lips together and tried to turn her face away, but he found her mouth, and while he kissed her, he opened her blouse and with his free hand took out her small breasts. Her nipples were standing out like ripe mulberries. She was as aroused as he was, but kicking and spitting with fury. He swung her round and threw her face down over the thick padded arm of the buttoned leather chair, pinning her with a hand between her shoulder blades and her bottom in the air. That's how they had administered the cane at Shaza's school. And now, while she screamed and kicked, he jerked the leather belt out of the loops of her jeans and pulled her trousers and panties down as far as her ankles and stepped in close behind her. Her buttocks were white and round, and they maddened him. Though she fought and struggled without let-up, at the same time she lifted her hips slightly and arched her back to make it easier for him. And only when it happened did she stop fighting and push back hard against him, sobbing with the effort of keeping pace with him. It was over very quickly for both of them, and she rolled over and pulled him down onto the chair and whispered raggedly into his mouth, "Well, that's one hell of a way to settle an argument, I'll give you that much."